Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on a shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, France 24, Radio Havana Cuba, and NHK World Radio Japan. We'll begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. A ceasefire in the war on Gaza has been announced but not yet implemented. An interview with Oliver McTernan, mediator and founder of Forward Thinking, an NGO addressing issues in the Middle East. He speculates on why Israel has stalled on ratifying the ceasefire. He talks about the roles played by Netanyahu, Trump, and Biden. He points out that the deal is a truce, not a permanent ceasefire, and that Trump may be better at controlling the situation in the region. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
News of a ceasefire deal for Gaza has been welcomed around the world. U.S. President Joe Biden and key mediator Qatar announced the agreement on Wednesday. It's aimed at releasing scores of Israeli hostages being held in Gaza and ending Israel's 15-month war against Hamas that has visited widespread devastation to the Gaza Strip and left tens of thousands of Palestinians dead. Now, the first phase of the ceasefire was due to take effect on Sunday. For that to happen, the Israeli cabinet needs to ratify the deal, and that's now in doubt. Oliver McTernan is director of the organization Forward Thinking and was involved in negotiations that led to the release of the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit in 2011. Though he has no formal role in the current talks over the war in Gaza, he regularly speaks with senior figures in Hamas and in the Israeli government. So welcome to DW. Could you speculate for us as to what is likely to be behind Israel's announcement that it will not ratify this deal because of Hamas, while Hamas says it's fully committed to the deal that was announced?
I'm not surprised with today's announcement. I think it was predictable. In my reading of it, I think this deal could have been done in July with all the feedback we got. It was blocked then by Benjamin Netanyahu, and I got that from Israeli sources, not from elsewhere. So I think it was predictable that he would find ways of delaying this deal. I think we're only where we are simply because of the Trump presidency. I think it was, if he had to reach a ceasefire agreement, I think it was also predictable he would wait till the last moment and give it to Trump then as a gift to the new president. But what we've got to keep in mind is that all along it's been in his political interests to keep this war going. Now, that's not because he was fearful that Ben-Gvir and Smotrich would leave the government. I think there was the added incentive, and that was to keep himself away from the day of accountability. Because the moment we have a complete and permanent ceasefire, it's the day that Benjamin Netanyahu will come under scrutiny. Scrutiny why October the 7th was such a security lapse and what was his role in that.
Okay, so if you, and I appreciate that we are speculating, but if you are right, then people are dying because of political considerations while until a Trump presidency can be inaugurated and Mr. Netanyahu can marshal his own political forces, which sounds cynical.
Well, I don't think it is cynical. I think it is the reality. I mean, even last night, I received from Gaza a video of the aftermath of an Israeli bombing in which 9 people, mainly children, were killed. A whole family was wiped out. It's tragic that we're talking about a truce, and that's what it is, because it's a temporary suspension of military operations by both sides. It's not a complete and permanent ceasefire immediately. We've got this drawn out, prolonged process until we reach that. But all the time, innocent people are dying, as well as the hostages and their families are suffering. So, you know, it isn't a good sign that we haven't immediately said this must be implemented immediately. I think it's not a good sign either that it's not a complete and permanent ceasefire that is being declared, but that we have this long drawn-out process. It's full of risks of it breaking down.
But the good news in your somewhat gloomy analysis seems to be that you expect the deal to be done when Mr. Netanyahu deems that the conditions are right.
I think the change in the White House is very significant. Joe Biden made a terrible error right at the beginning of this war when he said there are no red lines. And for the past 15 months, he has lived by that, that he has supplied all the military means that Prime Minister Netanyahu needed to prosecute this war. At no time did he put sufficient pressure on him to say, look, enough is enough. We've got to stop the scale of this killing. It's going to have long-term consequences. Trump, I think, is transactional. He's open. He's not interested, I think, in promoting principles. And I don't think any American president has been. It's always been a foreign policy dictated by their interests. But Trump is transparent about that and transactional. And I think he will want to pick up where he left off 4 years ago. Remember, 4 years ago, Trump stopped Netanyahu annexing big parts of the West Bank. And as a sort of compensation, you might say, for him, political compensation, he brought the Abraham Accords to him. Now, they've been stuck for the last 4 years because Saudi Arabia rightly are saying that unless there is real progress on a Palestinian state, not just a promise, but we want to see a Palestinian state, end of occupation, we can't enter into the accords in the way that the White House and the Israelis would want. Right. For Trump, the accords are big bucks. It will bring not just stability to the region and maybe a Nobel Prize for him, but it will give the American economy enormous financial benefit from deals that can be made.
That's a fascinating analysis, and we thank you for it. Oliver McTernan from the organization Forward Thinking, thank you so much.
That interview is from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. They're also available at most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. Next, France 24. First, a numerical summary of the death and destruction in Gaza. Then Israeli press reviews on the deal with Palestine, the fate of the hostages, and acceptance of Trump's influence. Then in his final days of office, Joe Biden has removed Cuba from the list of state sponsors of terrorism. France 24.
After more than 15 months of war, an ever-mounting death toll, and a narrow strip of land laid to waste, on the 14th of January, Gaza's health ministry said at least 46,645 people had been killed and 110,012 injured. It says more than half of the victims are women and children. But a study released in early January by peer-reviewed medical journal Lancet found that casualties in just the first 9 months of the war were underreported by 41%. With deaths already at 64,260 by the end of June. The United Nations estimates 1.9 million people in Gaza have been displaced at least once. That's 90% of the population. Given the sheer destruction, Many now live in tents. UN satellite imagery from September showed more than 65% of structures have been damaged. That's some 163,700 buildings. Gaza City, in the northern part of the Strip, is the worst affected, with more than 36,000 buildings damaged. A satellite assessment from July estimated the war had generated about 42 million tons of debris. That's 14 times more than all of the debris produced by the other conflicts in Gaza since 2008. By August, the UN satellite images showed 70% of Gaza's roads damaged, a factor that has complicated deliveries of humanitarian aid, while the WHO says that only 16 out of the Strip's 36 hospitals remain partially functional. The Israeli army claims to have killed some 17 to 20,000 militants from Hamas and other groups since the start of the war, but Israeli media have questioned the veracity of these figures, suggesting the army may not have always distinguished correctly between, quote, terrorist and civilian. Hamas losses include several brigade commanders and dozens of battalion commanders, as well as Yahya Sinwar, chairman of the Hamas Political Bureau and mastermind of the 7th of October attack. Meanwhile, at least 405 Israeli troops have died in operations inside the Strip and on the border since the beginning of the war.
All right, Leah, well, what about the reaction from the Israeli press?
I'll start with Israel Hayom, which is the most circulated newspaper in the country that has close ties to Israeli PM Benjamin Netanyahu. The front page has images of all the hostages with the headline, "On the Way Home." But it's not all celebration. This analysis piece inside the paper tells us that there are many questions left unanswered. The deal leads to a conclusion, they say. Israel is effectively giving up on one of their three war objectives. The deal leaves Hamas as the governing factor in Gaza, and it will allow them to re-establish themselves, they say. And it's a deal that's been condemned by many in the government, mainly Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir and Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich. As you can see in the Jerusalem Post, Smotrich has said that if Israel doesn't return to Gaza after the ceasefire, he will quit. He calls the deal a bad deal, as well as dangerous for Israel's national security. Ynet, which is the country's biggest news site, say there's a nerve-wracking 42 days ahead. The piece says that the roller coaster they are facing will demand patience, tolerance and compassion. Not knowing at the start of each day who is alive and who did not survive will be unbearable. I'll finish with the more left-leaning Haaretz, often critical of the Israeli government as well as Netanyahu. You can see the image of demonstrators showing relief at the agreement. They report that the first three Israeli female hostages will be released on Sunday. Analysis-wise, Haaretz have claimed that Netanyahu was essentially scared into accepting a ceasefire deal by Donald Trump. He rejected the same hostage deal when the Biden administration proposed it a few months ago, but he's now been bulldozed into wide-ranging concessions. Haaretz also have this, telling Israelis that they must swallow their pride and thank boorish bullying Trump. As the American saying goes, it was a dirty job, but someone had to do it. Haaretz finished saying that it might be true that Trump is a horrible, unstable, dangerous person, but in light of his action regarding the hostages, it's possible that sometimes you just need to speak clearly and do what has to be done without making everything so horribly complicated.
A new move from Joe Biden in his final days of office.
Exactly. Joe Biden announcing that he was removing Cuba, or wanted to remove Cuba from the list of state sponsors of terrorism. And it will be interesting to see if Marco Rubio, who is the son of Cuban immigrants, who, as you said, has been a proponent of those sanctions, has been very outspokenly critical of the Cuban government, whether he will be responding to any questions about what he thinks of Biden's move. This is something that effectively rolls back what Donald Trump had put in place, because it was Donald Trump himself who put Cuba on that list of state sponsors of terrorism in the final days of his administration before Joe Biden came into office. And it is very likely not going to last. Of course, you mentioned Marco Rubio, who is a proponent of sanctions. Donald Trump himself has been outspoken in being being tough on Cuba. And Mike Walz, the upcoming national security advisor, he celebrated the news that there would be releases of prisoners in Cuba. But he added, anything that they are doing, which is the Biden administration right now, we can do back. And no one should be under any illusion in terms of change in Cuba policy coming from the United States. We also heard from Senator Ted Cruz, who is also the son of a Cuban immigrant. He's called the move unacceptable on its merits and said that he would be working with Donald Trump and Marco Rubio to reverse that decision very quickly. And you had other Republican representatives, and there's some on the Democratic side also who are against lifting those sanctions and who continue to believe that a tough policy on Cuba is the only way forward.
Those reports and press reviews were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as on a YouTube channel called France 24 English. On to Radio Havana, Cuba. A viewpoint on the inauguration of President Maduro in Venezuela, while Joe Biden announced a $25 million bounty for his arrest. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro started his third term on January 10, opening a new year and a new era in his nation's transformative undertaking to build the Bolivarian socialist state initiated by his predecessor, Hugo Chavez. The president, starting his third term that will last until 2031, recalled that he took office in 2013, wearing Chavez's sasha, as he inherited and also intended to fulfill Chavez's main mission of continuing to build a new Venezuela, addressing over 2,000 delegates from 120 nations, as well as a nation and the world. Through a live telecast, Maduro assured that he and the ruling United Socialist Party of Venezuela remain committed not only to fulfilling the principles embedded in Chavez's legacy, but also to implement seven transformative policies during his second six-year term. Maduro indicated the seven transformations for change would include consolidation of prosperity in Venezuela, achieving economic diversification, expanding the Bolivarian doctrine, achieving peace, security, defense, and territorial integrity, recovering on social commitment, democracy, popular power, and participation, and combating the climate crisis. The president noted that his re-election and inauguration was an act of consolidation of a great constitutional victory and assured that Venezuela's unprecedented levels of national consultations will continue, indicating there will be a new national dialogue to reform the constitution. Maduro's inauguration at the National Assembly was attended by leaders from many Caribbean and Latin American nations, including Antigua and Barbuda's Prime Minister Gaston Brown, Bolivian President Luis Arce, Cuban President Miguel Canel, Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega, and St. Vincent and the Grenadines Prime Minister Ralph Gonsalves. President Maduro was congratulated in speeches by Arce and Ortega, while the Bolivarian Armed Forces pledged their continuing loyalty to the President and the Constitution. Following his third inauguration, the president embarked on a market across the streets of Caracas, where he was applauded by thousands of jubilant supporters gathered outside the Miraflores Presidential Palace and along city streets. The inauguration was incident-free, with delegates in Caracas both perplexed by and dismissive of the announcement by the outgoing Joseph Biden administration of a $25 million bounty for information leading to Maduro's arrest. Another of outgoing U.S. President Biden's last stance was to have Washington embrace and recognize Gonzalez as Venezuela's president. Again, just days before the one-term president departs the White House. Another last-minute decision was to remove Cuba from the spurious list of states that it claims sponsor terrorism, a measure that Washington had maintained since January 12, 2021.
That viewpoint was from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 5 p.m. to 11 at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you could stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific time. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report, or could help support this program like a steady supporter in Willits, California did this week, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com. Or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show airborne. Please join in the fun. And if you are listening on a public radio station, please, there's soon going to be an even greater need for your support as well. We'll conclude with NHK World Radio Japan. In South Korea, people are in the streets as political uncertainty continues. The former president refuses to testify while being held in detention. The Chinese president has called for greater cooperation with the European Union. Vietnam and Russia agreed to cooperating on the development of nuclear power. The Prime Minister of Greenland reiterated that their country is not for sale. The United Nations Secretary General Guterres says the world faces four major challenges in the year ahead. NHK Japan.
A South Korean court is debating whether the warrant used to detain President Yoon Suk-yeol was legal. The warrant's deadline had been extended. Yoon's supporters gathered Thursday in front of the detention center holding him. Yoon was taken in for questioning Wednesday after a long standoff with investigators. They intended to question him again Thursday, but Yoon refused to appear. His lawyer said he had already fully explained his position Wednesday. Now his lawyers are asking the court to rule on whether the detention itself is valid. The court began procedures Thursday to hear the arguments. Yoon's 48-hour detention period was set to expire Friday morning, but that doesn't include the time spent on screening procedures. Meanwhile, another South Korean court is grappling with its own Yoon case. The Constitutional Court is weighing whether or not Yoon's impeachment should be upheld. Yoon's defense team is arguing the declaration of martial law was just. The next hearing is scheduled for Tuesday.
Chinese President Xi Jinping has called for greater cooperation between his country and the European Union in a phone call with the European Council President. On Tuesday, Xi spoke with Antonio Costa, who assumed the presidency in December. China's foreign ministry says Xi expressed hope that the EU will prove to be a trustworthy cooperation partner. He added that economic and trade cooperation is mutually beneficial. The EU says Costa agreed that cooperation is preferable to competition. But he also stressed the need to ensure a level playing field and to rebalance the existing trade and economic imbalances. China and the EU have been at odds over the bloc's tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles and other matters. Xi's move may reflect concerns over potential trade tensions between the U.S. and China that could follow Donald Trump's inauguration as president. Trump is an advocate of protectionist policies.
Vietnam and Russia on Tuesday agreed to further deepen cooperation in the field of nuclear power. Vietnamese Prime Minister Pham Minh Chinh met Russian counterpart Mikhail Mishustin in Hanoi to sign an agreement on nuclear energy and other cooperation. The Vietnamese government froze a plan to build a nuclear power plant in 2016 due to cost and safety concerns. But domestic demand for power has increased, so it resumed the plan in November last year. The Southeast Asian country has had strong ties with Russia since the time of the Soviet Union. It has strengthened this relationship even after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Russia has been building nuclear power plants in emerging countries, taking advantage of its technological prowess in the field. Greenland's prime minister is reiterating his stance on Trump's offer to own the autonomous Danish territory. He says their land is not for sale. Muto Egudá told reporters that Greenland's people do not want to be either Danes or Americans. He said its future will be decided by the citizens of Greenland alone. The news conference follows repeated remarks by Trump that the U.S. needs to acquire the territory for purposes of national security. Egudá said Greenland instead hopes to work more closely with the U.S. on defense and exploring its mineral resources. Greenland currently relies on Denmark in terms of defense. The prime minister's remark apparently reflects the territory's hope to gain independence from Denmark in the future. Egudá also dismissed possible cooperation with Russia, saying Greenland is well entrenched with Western countries.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says the world faces four major challenges in the year ahead: runaway conflicts, rampant inequalities, the climate crisis, and out-of-control technology.
Our actions or inactions have unleashed a modern-day Pandora's box of ills.
Guterres told a UN General Assembly meeting on Wednesday the nuclear threat is at its highest in decades. The Secretary General also criticized how international law violations have become routine, along with systematic assaults on UN institutions. Guterres highlighted the recent deadly wildfires in Los Angeles when addressing the climate crisis. He urged the international community to work harder to fight against climate change and stressed the need to deliver on the goals of the Paris Agreement. Guterres also called for international guardrails around new technology to uphold human rights and prevent misuse. He says these advances offer unprecedented opportunities which require careful stewardship.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan. On shortwave, they're heard at 9 p.m. Pacific Time at 11735. Or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp, as well as most podcast sites. All the times I've announced are for Pacific time, so adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You will have to look even harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for the show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The shortwave report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury, so I'm staying in a house that's connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.